is SAE International Podcast Series. I'm Monica Nogueira with the Aerospace Group. Today, talking with Sean Barker in the UK, an aerospace engineer, mathematician, and a person with a lot of experience in dealing with systems engineering. Sean, thank you so much for talking with us. Please tell us more about you, your background, your work. There is a lot. You have had a very long and successful and interesting career.
Yeah, it's probably fairly complicated to explain all the details. Essentially, I'm a mathematician by trade, but I've spent much of my career wandering along the border between systems engineering and software engineering. I originally started at designing radar systems for Marconi and then moved over to writing computer-aided design software for British Aerospace. From that, I then got into exchanging product management data, which is a lot about talking to the design office, particularly those who look after design standards and configuration management. After that, going via a secondment in Paris, I ended up in the BAE Systems Advanced Technology Centre. I started there working on design management and data standards, and that brought in work particularly on product data lifecycle support standard and also on long-term data sustainment. I was also involved in quite a number of other R&D strands, including emergency response, shipbuilding design processes, knowledge management, policy-based security, and distributed database queries. If there's a common thread, it's the relationship between knowledge, information, and data, and how the meaning of information is grounded in the behavior of the systems that act on it, particularly the business processes.
So you recently published a book with SAE, and the title is Aircraft is a System of Systems, a Business Process Perspective. That sounds very much like the coalescence of all this experience in the end. At a high level, I understand. Can you talk a little bit more about this project? It sounds extremely interesting.
Well, it's quite difficult to put succinctly. The whole book is just an exploration of the different implications of a single idea. Essentially, designing an aircraft is too big a problem and too complex a problem for one person. Unfortunately, when you expand out the idea, that itself is large and complicated, and to go into a detail would need a book larger than any one person would ever really want to read. So I've used the ideas of system and business process to skim over the surface so that readers can get an overall impression of how aircraft companies still actually manage to design an aircraft, even if it's that complicated. I suppose my starting point was a presentation I gave to a group of senior engineering managers about how their processes actually worked, and of course, how they could improve them. One of the key messages was that engineering doesn't follow a nice, neat, linear process, because there's a lot of crosstalk and feedback, both between the different processes and different process threads. Project managers often look at progress against a schedule, but the list of activities on an engineering schedule is a bit more like a shopping list of things they need to actually get done, as opposed to a promise to do them by this date. A schedule looks like a neat way of managing something, but it's only if you deal with the engineering as it actually works that you have any control over the process. This was a message that those engineering managers all recognised, and it's one they wish they could get through to their senior management. What was tricky with the book is how to tease out the web of interconnected threads into a relatively straightforward story. So I start by discussing a simple mechanical part, a component in a mechanism, and looked at how the different people have different expertises, and these are all needed to bring about the design. As I said, the key idea is each individual engineer knows only so much, and they have to talk to several other people to build up the full picture. And the process is about how you get the people to talk to each other at the right time. Because if a person is involved too early, then they don't really have anything useful to contribute at that point. Whereas if you get them in too late, they might spot something they should have done earlier, and everybody else has got to go back and rework what they've done. From then on, you have to start laying on the complications. The next level of complexity is the system, which is generally a team effort. If you imagine the design of a simple part as one conversation, then the system design has several conversations going on in parallel, except they're all talking about different aspects of the same thing. And so the people need to cross between conversations, because if they don't, they end up designing several different systems.
Sean, this sounds very interesting, but awfully complex. How do you achieve a minimum of viability among groups that are all working on the same huge project, say a new aircraft? How do you accomplish that? And is this something that there is a one way to solve, or there are many ways to solve this challenge?
I think there's not one way to work your way through the design of an aircraft. The problem is to get everybody talking who needs to be talking. That's actually too complicated a question really to start with. Probably the better starting point is actually thinking about something smaller like a system. A system is a collection of components put together so they do a particular job. It's not simply a collection of parts, because the way they're put together is important. For example, if you take a collection of Lego blocks, you can put them together in one way to get a car, and if you put them with the wheels on top, you're making a conveyor belt. Now, originally systems started out when one function of an aircraft became too complicated so that it needed its own specialist engineers. I mean, I started out as a radar systems engineer working on the probability of a signal exceeding noise, and then on the signal processing of how to make the noise less and the signal stronger. As a system, the radar was part of an aircraft that was being designed. But I didn't need to know anything about aircraft engineering, or even that you actually had to have wings to fly. But then nor did the aircraft engineers need to know how a radar worked. A system is built around a particular body of knowledge. That allows a sensible set of conversations to start around one particular area. And aircraft and ships and cars and many other things are all built around systems. An aircraft, for example, will have a flight control system, a fuel system, a navigation system, a cabin air system, and so on. They have their own specialist engineers in each system. However, there's a core of ideas and common techniques, and these are brought together as a separate discipline called systems engineering. For example, the first thing that any system design needs is a set of requirements so you know what the customer wants. Once you've actually worked through, you need to check whether the system you've designed actually meets those requirements. So you actually have to deal with a model of requirements that says these requirements meet up with this bit of the system, and then back check that when you've gone through the system, all the requirements are met. And of course, you also have to cope with the fact that customers tend to change their mind exactly what you want, particularly when you've told them how expensive their requirement is. So the idea of systems engineering is to use a common set of methods. I say the requirements model is one of the basic methods. Much of systems engineering is focused on behaviours, for example, control loops between a system, its sensors, and the actuators that drive it. For example, a sensor shows the room temperature is too low, so heating is switched on. But if you leave the heating on for too long, it overheats. So your problem is to design a system which has an effective model that allows you to turn off the heating early enough so you don't get the overshoot. Model-based systems engineering formalises overall systems engineering approaches into a set of interrelated models. So, for example, a model of a control system is linked to the requirements it fulfills. It then becomes straightforward to check back to find whether the requirements that the control system was actually supposed to fulfil actually have been fulfilled. The tools that support this modelling also help with consistency and completeness, effectively checking that all the conversations are talking about the same thing, that everything that should be mentioned has been mentioned. No requirement has been forgotten. Perhaps one of the reasons for the rise in an interest in system engineering will be similar for those for all sorts of engineering. To recall an old quote, an engineer is someone who could do for sixpence what any fool can do for a shilling. I think the US equivalents are a nickel and a dime. Engineering is about discipline and consistency and making sure things actually work the way they're supposed to work. The problem is that things are getting more complicated because engineers keep finding better and cheaper ways of doing things. But these better ways require more engineering knowledge, and the margins for error are less. It's sort of the case that we've already designed something quite well, but change an analogy to mountain climbing. If you've got to 28,000 feet, then the only thing you can do to climb any higher is go up Everest. I write about it from the business process perspective because actually it's also the first step of specifying system design as a system in its own right. But then we're getting into meta concepts, which are a bit more difficult to explain, and it probably needs a few more years of work to actually get it spread out properly.
So, Sean, as a continuation of this set of ideas, can you talk a little bit more about systems of systems in systems of many systems? We have been hearing that more and more. Can you tell us what these concepts are all about?
Well, start with system of many systems. And the system of many systems is one where the overall system, like an aircraft, is built up of many separate systems, each of which have their own behavior. But just because they have a behavior, it doesn't mean to say you still don't have to coordinate the design of the whole system. It's got to work as a whole and not have one bit doing something where the other bits are trying to do something else. For example, the fuel is held in our fuel tank. As far as the engine's concerned, it doesn't really care where it gets the fuel from. But if all the fuel ended up in one wing, then the aircraft would tend to fall over sideways. Consequently, you design the fuel system so that it corresponds to the way the plane flies. So you move fuel between the fuel tanks to keep it balanced. And if you go a bit further, in the old Concorde aircraft, the wings used to heat up due to the speed it flew, so the fuel system also pumped around fuel to cool the wings. So that's quite a common thing in aircraft, is that they're often optimised so that a single component does multiple jobs. So, for example, fuel and coolant. Another example is, for example, the box that the electronics comes in. That's obviously a box to take everything off in one go safely. But it also acts as the duct for all the cooling air that's needed to keep the right temperature in the electronics. The term system of systems originally covered much the same ground of systems of many systems, but it's now got a more specialist meaning. In particular, it refers to an overall system where the components are largely autonomous. We see this on smart motorways. Each driver drives independently of every other driver. But if the traffic is fairly dense, one driver going a bit slowly will slow down the cars behind them, at least until they can overtake. But when they overtake, they change lanes and take up room in that lane, making everybody else in that lane slow down. And this creates a sort of shockwave that builds up and travels back along the motorway. So about 3 or 4 miles further back down the motorway, the whole road stops, even though there's nothing blocking it. A system of systems, such as a smart motorway, then monitors the behaviour of the road as a whole, with cameras, for example, and then reduces the speed limit so that the fast people are not trying to overtake all the time. And that stops the build-up of shockwaves. And actually, by slowing down these fast people, it actually increases the overall capacity for everybody on the road.
So this is super interesting. How does that apply to aircraft design? In other type of aircraft related projects then?
I suppose you only really appreciate what goes on in an aircraft factory if you work there, because that's where you see how big the aircraft design problem is. I once remember talking to somebody from the computer industry saying, oh, they've got a really big project. They've got 100 people on the job. Now, actually, that's a really tiny project. I used to sit in the computer-aided design team where I was writing the software tools that would be used by the design office. And we just sat down on one end of a hangar, and the design office then filled the rest of the hangar and the next three hangars. And it was a 10-minute walk to the systems engineering building, 20-minute drive to the other side of the airfield to talk to the advanced projects people. And every so often, I'd actually take one of our regular evening flights across to Germany to work with my equivalents in Otterburn near Munich. That was a big factory because they had eagles nesting on their buildings. The size of an organisation needed for just one aircraft makes it very difficult to get an overall feel for a project. That's why, actually, in the book, I talk about small units like the 100-person team that develops ground equipment or the 300 people or so who are involved in designing a warship. When you look at these sort of sizes of teams, what you see is there are lots of chains of communication crisscrossing the organisation. For example, you might have a sub-team that will design a pervasive system, such as the air conditioning in a ship. There is a nice self-contained problem, but it affects everybody in the ship. When the problem is actually completely self-contained, such as a radar, you'd actually even take that out of the design organisation and send it across to a different design team in a different company. So what you have is lots of conversations going on at the same time. And what you've got to do is make sure that everything works together. And there are actually specialist teams who will deal with integration. For example, you've got the physical integration team who make sure all the equipment fits inside the space you've got available. But then you've also got the systems integration team, ensuring that when system A wants to talk to system B is listening. So one of the ways of trying to get a handle on all this conversation is trying to understand what are the flows of design knowledge. One of the things that I particularly appreciate because I've done a lot of information exchange, is there are actually four different directions of travel. Firstly, you've got a long process going from one design stage to the next. For example, once the design engineer has worked out the shape of a part, the manufacturing engineer goes on to work out how to make it. Secondly, you've got flows down into sub-processes, where a general system design is elaborated as subsystems. For example, the navigation system, somewhere in it will need access to a GPS receiver. Then you've got cross-process flows, where you've got lots of people working in the same sort of design area, but on different areas of the design. So, for example, you have the people designing an engine, but they've got to do it in such a way that it will fit in to the wing and the nacelle around the wing. So you actually have to exchange designs between those teams. And then finally, the fourth direction is where actually you've communicated across time, because every so often you have to go back and revisit the design, perhaps because there are new requirements come in, perhaps there's a new aircraft directive from the FAA or somebody like that. This is a slightly more complicated area, which we don't really understand entirely, because it lasts over 40 to 70 years for a typical aircraft. And that's difficult because the average CAD system, which everything is designed on, gets rewritten every 10 years. One of the slight problems there is that the software writers are really all excited about the new features and tend to leave the reading old parts to the end of the development process. And sometimes they don't work quite as you would expect them to. I suppose a key correlation here is that systems is not only a technical concept, but it has a corresponding organisational unit. That's because the people working on a particular system need most to talk to other engineers on the same team. I mean, as a junior radar engineer, I didn't actually talk to anybody who designed aeroplanes. I just talked to the people who designed the scanner and the signal processing. People actually who had to work out how to put the radar into the aircraft would have been further up the design chain, you know, the more senior engineers.
So, Sean, what you describe is of such magnitude that for somebody who is not deeply involved in this process, it sounds like almost ungraspable. How do you make sure, if you could tell us, how do you make sure that these systems not only integrate well, as you had mentioned before, but also that the level and speed of escalation from one level of the design project to the next flows well? What are the challenges that keep coming back dressed in different clothes, if I could put this whole question that way? Because people are people. You can teach them so much, but yet, you know, the experience for some continues to be new as new engineers come on board. How does that challenge get resolved?
Essentially, that you have a community of engineers who knew what happened the last time. This actually gets problematical in modern aircraft design, in the military at least, because you only design an aircraft about every 20 years. And that means it actually takes much longer to design because you've got to relearn all the iterations. I also talk to people in the shipbuilding area. They have exactly the same problem. They don't design enough ships really to keep the level of expertise up to what they would like. Something like the commercial aircraft industry, they have a much more frequent design cycle. That keeps the level of expertise up. But essentially what you're seeing is people who know how to do the last project working out how to do the next project and using that expertise to say, these are the things we probably want. It's probably going to take us this long, and they're probably always a bit optimistic. I remember once costing one particular fairly small development, and I worked out how long it would take me to do it. Then I doubled it because one's always optimistic. And then I looked at the people I've got to do it, and I doubled it again because they had to learn all the things that were necessary. This is one of the reasons why cost estimation in aerospace is always a bit tricky, because you have a lot of people who are coming up and being developed in the process. One of the things that's quite important is to actually understand how your knowledge flows from your past generation to your future generation. One of the things you tend to get is a discussion about whether the specialist should be embedded directly within the teams doing the work, because that's where the knowledge is needed. But the problem is that if you do that, they tend to lose their specialism because they need to talk to all sorts of other people in the same specialism. So there's no right solution. There is a quote that used to sit on people's walls, is that this is from a Roman general, is that every time they realised there was a problem, they used to reorganise so nobody could remember what the last problem was. Essentially, you need to keep reorganising because the problems that one organisation solves creates different problems which the other organisation solves. So it's an interesting challenge for the management at that point.
So let me add another layer of complication. What do you think about the impact of big data and connectivity when you look at the interconnections, the various touch points of these systems of systems when you're dealing with, again, the Internet of Things, big data, and interconnectivity?
First, I'm going to make a distinction between big data and small data. Because quite often with small data problems, you can have quite a lot of data. For example, the SAA book on integrated vehicle health monitoring. Here, the data set was for 25 stress sensors on an aircraft. And that's a fairly simple data set to deal with. However, if that data is accumulated across a whole, every flight of every aircraft in the fleet, then after 25 years, with current technology, it would take you about 3 months to download it. And that's a small data problem because we know exactly what the data is. The difficulty is the sheer scale of the processing it. A lot of what people talk about in the big data arena is processing and collecting and processing large quantities of unstructured and semi-structured data. For example, there's a financial services company called Garlic that originally offered service to banks that would go and look at criminal websites who were offering to sell credit card details, scrape the data off, reformat it into a structure they were using, and then process that to see if any of their customers' cards had been compromised. Now, behind this is a computer model based on triple stores, which is, you know, one of the AI techniques. And together with that, they had a computer architecture which allowed them to actually scale up these to really big problems. So they're working on a quite different sort of set of problems in that big data arena than the aerospace. Because much of the aerospace data is already in databases, where it's written down in forms, so it's already structured. The difficulty there is many of these structures are recursive and time varying. For example, you've got assemblies which are made up of sub-assemblies, which are made up of sub-sub-assemblies, and so on. Moreover, the actual makeup of any assembly will vary depending on what year it was actually built. These two aspects of sort of information in aerospace make it quite difficult to process using conventional database techniques. And moreover, just to make it slightly worse, some vital data, such as part number, changes its meaning between processes. For example, technically, a part number is an instance identifier in a design process. It's the number of one design. Put in class identifier in manufacturing and support because you make lots of parts to that design. This makes automatic querying computationally hard. I'm never quite sure quite why people in aerospace are interested in big data, because I haven't really seen the details of the problems they're talking about, or whether they're just being sold some hype by people who are selling big data technology. There's a real question to answer there, but I'm not sure where the answer sits at the moment. Obviously, integrated vehicle health monitoring produces a huge amount of data, and it creates some big data problems connecting all the sensors together. But I'm not sure where the state of the art is at the moment on that one. If you talk about connectivity, though, that's a horse of a different colour. Supporting an aircraft in service involves links to many different systems, many of which are systems of systems. For example, because you connect everything up together now, you should be able to connect up to plan the maintenance of an aircraft based on when the spares will be manufactured. And to that, you need to connect to the aircraft scheduling so that it's not taken out of the flight line when it's needed. You've then got to connect up to the integrated health monitoring system to see what you actually need to do, to the task maintenance system to see which tasks are needed and therefore what spares are needed, and then to manufacturing ERP so that find out when they're available. There's quite a lot of challenges trying to bring these things together because information standards exist, but they're all different in the different processes. And just because you've got two information models, it doesn't mean to say they'll work together. You certainly don't want to take the big data approach of sucking all the data out of the original systems and putting it into a mashup system. partly because some of the database queries on an aircraft can take hours to run, and also may lock out the users from the system, which tends to upset them. But also, you really need to look at live data, because data changes throughout the day, and you don't want to be planning on the basis of yesterday's data. And this is where I was involved in some of these distributed database queries. Connectivity also makes updating the IT systems far more challenging, since because it's connected to many more systems, there are many more interfaces to keep in line. Software developers are not very good at keeping to any particular interface standard. So you're often having to explore whether the new software actually works with your existing software.
So, Sean, what are the challenges that are the big ones that the aerospace industry is looking at? And what are the ones that you think at this point have been properly addressed?
I'd say the ones that have been properly addressed are making airplanes fly safely, because they're doing that and have been doing it extremely well for many years. The ones they're still trying to deal with are exactly these moving forward to adopt new technologies and to take the cost out of existing aircraft design. Where this is becoming more challenging is that because actually aerospace is a relatively small sector, if you look in terms of the overall commercial markets. I mean, it might sound odd to say aerospace is a small sector, but compared to automotive or telecoms, it's definitely second tier. So as far as engineering technology is concerned, aerospace is traditionally led in many areas, but now some of the other technology sectors are taking over. For example, for microwave components, that used to be driven much by the military and uses like radar and the radios that connect everything together. But currently, it's now being driven by the telecoms for 5G and also for things like radars in automotive. Now, they're pushing much harder because they have a lot more money to spend in the end to get the technology moving forward. And also, they have a much shorter design cycle, so that the technology changes far more often. Now, this is a problem for aircraft manufacturing, because if you have to replace a component partway through the life of an aeroplane, it's going to cost you extra to keep the aircraft flying. Another challenge is that one of the ways of bringing down costs and improving quality is to move to model-based engineering. And this is actually quite a hot topic these days in LinkedIn. The trouble is, the software is being developed for other sectors. And the original high-end CAD packages were all developed by the aerospace industry, but now it's just one customer-based, with the automotive being actually a much larger company. However, the requirements of aerospace for both quality and interoperability are actually very high, and one has to occasionally talk to the software manufacturers and remind them rather forcibly that these are our requirements and we would like them. And we're not quite a small sector that we ignored, but their focus is obviously on the big sectors. A better example I can bring from the 1990s about aircraft lifecycle was that an outsourcing company was actually completely shocked to suddenly discover that on taking the contract, they were supposed to be maintaining punch card readers. Now, punch card readers were already obsolete in the 1980s, but in aerospace, the original CAD systems were driven from punch cards. And still in the mid-90s, there were quite a lot of aircraft designs which were still operating and still covered by support contracts, where all the design was still stored on punch cards. So obsolescence of electronics and software is likely to be the most obvious symptom of technology change. Another challenge is actually knowledge obsolescence. Because even if you can keep the old software running, lack of practice will mean the old engineers no longer remember how to use it. Well, the technology will be incomprehensible to new graduates. These days, you probably have to explain that a floppy disk is neither floppy nor round. I remember an example early in my career. In the 1980s, we were actually working on digital radar at the time, but actually the analog radars still hadn't gone out of the development phase. And we were actually asked to do an analysis of the comparison between a digital and an analog radar. And what I found was the engineer I actually asked to do this work could not comprehend how primitive the old analog radar seemed to her. It was just a different concept. Well, and you can imagine that, for example, going between valves and transistors to integrated circuits, the whole way of doing things changes, and it's forgotten by later generations.
So the question then that we would have for you is for these new generations of engineers coming into the aerospace industry, what would you tell them? What is it that they should focus on? What are the big decisions that they will have to be making in a different way than what your generation had to make?
Well, that's a tricky one because my career was rather serendipitous. I didn't stay in any one job for more than about 3.5 years. I mean, sometimes it was just a change from designing one radar to another. But other times it was a much more radical change from designing radar to designing CAD algorithms. I'm also a sort of technical hypergeek, so I didn't have the problem of trying to manage people. There were far more sensible people to do that. But that meant I've always been at the leading edge of technology, so I have a very wide perspective over a large number of technologies. I should also say I have an engineer's perspective, which is quite important, which is to deliver what the customer asked for, to schedule, to cost, and to quality, which meant my managers never had to explain why their projects failed, because they didn't fail. And they were very happy to keep me playing with the technology. But the main thing I think you appreciate is that engineers need lots of ideas. From a practical point of view, one of the things the engineer should do is just read around their subject. A good introductory book on the subject gives you an overview of the field. So if you want to go deeper, then you know how the topic fits into the wider picture. Academic papers can also be a source, although as a generalist, I found only a very small proportion were useful to answer the sort of big questions I've been dealing with. I find Wikipedia very useful, at least for engineering topics, because it gives you the starting point in a fairly digestible form. And actually, one of the best sources of ideas is engineering standards. One of the difficulties is actually reading them, because they're written from the point of view of, this is what we know is the answer, but doesn't tell you why it is the answer. And you have to do some further reading around that to understand that. So it's getting more ideas, which is the key point, rather than just assuming that what you learned at university is more than about 10% relevant.
Thank you, Sean. This has been a conversation that really sheds light on a lot of different topics. I'm sure Sean will be talking again. For now, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us.
Well, I thank you for giving me this opportunity to write a book, which I probably wouldn't quite have got round to writing by now, because it would be too complicated for me to actually do it unless I had a publisher's schedule. So thank you very much for that. And I hope people in the aerospace industry, I won't say enjoy it, but appreciate it.
Thank you so much again. This is SAE International Podcast Series, and I'm Monica Nogueira with Aerospace Group.